It's the 19th of April 2013 and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a multi-award winning podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Just how dangerous is fertiliser? Is it possible to hack into a plane using a phone? And will you ever want to fly again after hearing this week's show? If the academic justification for austerity is based on an accounting error, is there still hope that George Osborne is actually just all in our heads? And why do we have to keep fighting the same old battles over the MMR vaccine? But before we begin, two things. Number one, the begging slot, of course. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. And all donations help us keep paying all the bills, the server bills, that sort of thing, and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. And now the second thing. Last Saturday was the QED conference in Manchester, and there was an award ceremony, the Skeptic Magazine's Occam Awards. Astonishingly, we managed to win our second Occam Award. Last year we won Best Podcast, and this year we picked up the Editor's Choice Award. Me and Liz were both pretty shocked by this, and would like to thank not only you all for listening, but all of our contributors. We've got well over 100 and something contributors now, and without them we couldn't keep making the show week in, week out, to the quality we do. But anyway, we can't get complacent, so let's get on with the show. Now, as you can probably tell, it's been a bad week for things not exploding in America. Yesterday's explosion in Waco at a fertiliser plant saw a depressingly high number of casualties. Given that it seems to be an accident, though, and that there are probably a fair few fertiliser plants around, should we worry about explosions? I mean, I already worry about nuclear war, global warming and how Doctor Who's lost its way, but should I add random explosions to the list? To find out, Kash Farouk has been speaking to friend of the show, Claire Benson, who's a fire and explosion scientist, to find out.
Hi Claire, you've contributed to the Pod Delusion a few times, but for people who don't know, can you introduce yourself and explain what your day job is?
My name is Claire Benson and I work at the Explosion and Fire Research Group at London South Bank University. And we do various kinds of research into fires and explosions, but particularly in industrial situations.
Okay, which explains why we're talking to you today after the huge sort of fatal explosion at the fertilizer factory last night in West, which is a town near Waco in Texas. Witnesses describing it as a war zone and like a tornado. So I thought we'd start with the basics, like the chemistry of fertilizer. So what is it made of and what makes it explosive?
Well, honestly, it depends on the fertilizer. And in this case, it's been reported that we're dealing with nitrogen-containing chemicals. But the problem is that the press are actually reporting two different substances, so I'm going to have to deal with them both. One is anhydrous ammonia, or ammonia, as chemists tend to call it, and the other is ammonium nitrate, and these are actually very different things.
Okay, so, you know, are they generally dangerous while they're just sitting around, or, you know, does something have to happen to make them dangerous?
In terms of explosion, I would say generally they're not very dangerous, although it depends very much on the circumstances. Actually, I would suspect officials are probably far more worried about the injury and illness caused by ammonia fumes, because it's a really nasty gas in terms of respiratory problems and actually burns because it rapidly dehydrates things, causing a kind of frostbite. But yes, so in terms of explosions, they're not hugely dangerous. Ammonium nitrate can and is used as an explosive, but it's actually what we call a blasting agent. In order to get it to explode, or in fact chemically decompose, you need an incredibly high amount of energy. So if, for example, you were going to create a bomb, you would have some kind of chemical additive, which would be a high explosive, to release a lot of energy and create a pressure wave, which would set off that decomposition. It can be set off by fire as well, but those are even rarer circumstances. You need to have some sort of fire contained so that all the energy is focused on raising the temperature of the ammonium nitrate. On the other hand, if we're talking about anhydrous ammonia, now that's naturally a gas. It's pumped directly into the soil for use as a fertilizer. But it's often stored as a liquid under high pressure. And there are a number of things that may or may not have occurred if that's the thing that's actually exploded. That's actually the chemical that's being reported by most of the news agencies as having exploded. It's got an extremely high ignition temperature and quite a high, what we call lower explosive limit. So you need a lot of it mixed with the air in order to explode. That's a very specific set of conditions. If a tank breached, that might happen, especially if you've got a fire already there. If the tank became breached and it was mixed with some sort of dust or oil, and then the ignition of that contaminant set off the gas, that could also be a cause of what happened. The final thing that might have happened, if this were the material involved, is something called a blevy. That's a boiling liquid evaporating vapor explosion. Now, this is where pressure is building up inside a sealed vessel with liquid that desperately wants to turn into a vapor cloud. Sometimes it involves venting gases as well, but basically you have liquid that wants to turn into gas, and as soon as a breach occurs, it does that, and then you have a flash phase change, and a massive cloud of vapor floods out. And sometimes if it finds an ignition, again, that can be the cause of some sort of explosion.
Okay, so there's an infamous use of fertilizers as an explosive, which is the Oklahoma bombing in 95. Is there any similarities or differences between the sort of chemicals involved, the chemical processes involved?
Well, again, it depends on the information you're getting. Oklahoma did involve ammonium nitrate, and in this case, what somebody had done was they put a high explosive with it to set off that decomposition process I described earlier. From the sounds of it, it's completely an accident that's happened in West. So I'm not sure how closely you can bring those together. I know it was a truckload of ammonium nitrate, so I suspect there was actually probably more material involved that we've seen, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, do you know how much damage has been done in West, sort of what the blast radius is?
Well, again, the blast radius is being reported differently by different people. I've seen that the really bad blast radius is reported at being between 2 and 5 blocks. So by my estimate, that's between 400 and 1,000 metres. But we don't know how large the crater is. We don't know what the total blast radius is. And we don't know the height of the mushroom cloud. And these are the things that help investigators calculate something called TNT equivalents. These help us understand how powerful an explosion was and how bad it was.
Okay, so at the moment you just can't infer that.
Well, yeah, because it even depends on the circumstances of where the blast occurred. They can completely change. One incident I did see listed, which struck me as being a little similar, was an explosion in Toulouse at the AZF factory, where they had 300 tons of ammonium nitrate, which exploded. This was reported to be equivalent to between 20 and 40 tons of TNT. And in this case, the explosion measured 3.4 on the Richter scale. Now, the West explosion is reported at 2.1, but that doesn't mean that was a lesser explosion. It just might be different conditions.
Okay, so let's move on to your pet subject of health and safety. So I saw quite a few tweets this morning from people shocked at how close the plant was to the town. So were you surprised?
I was surprised at seeing quite how close everything was. But I think that was probably just from a regular person point of view, more than a health and safety scientist. I decided to have a look into it because I was intrigued, because the only factories I'd ever really encountered were sort of in the middle of nowhere or on industrial parks, so surrounded by other industrial buildings. The thing that surprised me about the West plant was not how close the buildings were, but the use of the buildings, particularly the home for the elderly and the school, that were, looked to me from Google Maps, to be less than 250 metres away. And I've compared this to what the Health and Safety Executive recommends in this country. And they actually changed the separation zone that they recommend between those sorts of activities and vulnerable members of the public. And it's a minimum of 300 metres for smaller buildings. And actually for the larger buildings, so something I think like the buildings they're looking at in America, they actually recommend an exclusion zone of 400 metres between a factory or a plant producing these kinds of chemicals and those sorts of vulnerable people. However, I've also seen documents in South Australia that, because of ammonia fumes, recommend a distance of 1,000 metres. Now, whether that's just an evacuation distance or whether that's a building distance, I'm not entirely sure. But it certainly brings up a number of questions as to how planning works out there and why those sorts of vulnerable individuals might have been so close.
Okay, so let's talk about inspections. Do you know anything about US inspections for this sort of plant?
The only thing I've read recently was in the Washington Post, and they've actually done some investigation themselves, and they discovered that the Texas fertilizer industry has only seen 6 inspections in the past 5 years, and the West Texas Fertilizer Company plant was not one of the plants inspected. Now, that may be because it's merely a storage plant, because I've seen that reported. Or it may just be because they have so many plants, particularly in Texas. I mean, they've got a lot of oil. So their chemical safety people might be busy inspecting the oil plants and have not gone into the fertilizer plants so much. But of course, that's all speculation.
And continuing with the health and safety theme, I'm sure everyone's seen the sort of camcorder footage of the explosion. Somebody was filming it from a car. On seeing that video, my first thought was, if that person was a resident of the town, why did they not know to evacuate the area? So I was wondering if there are any regulations that force companies to, you know, have safety drills that involve the public.
I'm really not sure about America. I know here they have a certain amount. They have to contact the authorities if there's something going on. I have read of cases in the US where authorities have not been told quite as quickly as they perhaps should have been. Some chemical companies, for example, have their own fire brigades and deal with things on site. I'm not sure how big this plant is or whether they would have had their own people. One thing that strikes me is that West is not a large town. So even with correct telling of authorities, calling everybody in who needs to be brought in, they just may not have been able to deal with such an immense fire. And you're right. I am surprised there wasn't more of an exclusion zone. But then if you don't expect a tank to go, and if you don't think something's dangerous, you might not even think to do that.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there. Claire Benson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, a story did the rounds this week about a security expert who has managed to take control of aeroplanes. Yes, you heard that correctly. Apparently, using an Android app, it would be theoretically possible for someone to fly a plane. Luckily, though, Hugo Tezo is one of the good guys and has already told the people who, you know, need to know these things, but it does make me worry, as it turns out that aeroplanes are basically big flying Unix boxes, and everything I've ever tried to do with Unix or Linux has ended up crashing. But are these reports correct? And just how easy is it to take over a plane? Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Hugo to find out the real story.
Could you talk us through what you've been able to do with your smartphones?
Oh yeah, with the smartphone I've been able to do almost nothing. So the smartphone, as I have tried to explain many times after my talk, the smartphone application is just a user interface and that's all. All the real work, it's been done by a lot of computers and radio hardware, which are sitting somewhere else. And you can see on some of the slides a picture of my lab. These are the laptops and computers that do all the real job. The Android application is just a user interface that makes easier to communicate with it, but it's doing nothing by its own.
That makes me far more relieved.
I'm glad to hear that.
So this is a really interesting story that you managed to basically, I guess, kind of hack planes. Why did you decide to do this?
As you may already know, I'm an IT security working for Enrant, and I've been on IT security for many years now, but I'm also a commercial pilot. And as commercial pilot, I try to be always aware of the new technologies being implemented into aviation. For the last years, a lot of new technologies have been developed and deployed. And I was starting to be a little bit concerned about the security of those new technologies. So one day I just decided to start looking to the security of these technologies and try to figure out if they were secure or not. That's how everything started.
So could you explain briefly, and I know you're keeping lots of the details secret for obvious reasons, but how does this actually work? How do you intercept plane and radio traffic and all the things that you were doing?
Oh, maybe it's easier than you may think. I'm not intercepting anything, and it's just that for many years now, ground stations and air traffic control or airlines, people sitting on the ground, let's say, have managed to get in contact almost real time with airplanes using different technologies. Technologies that have been evolved and improved for the last years. I just use those technologies for the same they are being designed for, which is talk with the airplanes while they are on flight. Specifically, some of those technologies talk with, let's say, kind of computers on board the airplanes. So I use those same technologies to also talk with those computers. The only difference is that I use those communication channels in order to go over some security issues on those computers and somehow being able to gain partial control on the actions being taken by and decisions by these computers.
And what are the sort of things that you could do when you have this link set up?
On my talking at Hacking the Box, I focus on one specific system called the Flight Management Computer System. Flight management system, which, among other things, has a computer. And this system is taking care of navigation and guidance of the airplane. So if I'm able to go over this computer and somehow modify its behavior, I will be able to, up to a certain point, control or modify the navigation and guidance of the airplane.
That's pretty scary. I know in the article we read said that the pilot could actually take over. So would there be a situation where this would be incredibly dangerous, like where they wouldn't necessarily take control back?
I kept on purpose this research as safe as possible. So, yeah, the pilot can always just re-engage the control of the airplane, either by disengaging the autopilot, disconnecting some systems, just going back the just all day's flight. No, there's no problem on that. And the control I may have is partial, as I said. So there's not such a big issue. It's scary because from the ground you are going to be able to somehow control an onboard system, and it's always scary. Maybe with the appropriate planning and timing, as I said during my talk, you can do more or less danger or have better or less control on the airplane. But yeah, anyway, as I said also many times, I kept my research on purpose away from real airplanes. So I know that all the security issues I have found apply to real airplanes, but none of my code can be used against real airplanes, which I think it's a huge difference. And we worked really hard to keep that this way.
And the security issues that you found out seem really quite scary. Is this type of, I guess, communication, which it is, are other industries similarly not protected, or is this kind of a unique case?
Well, as for my experience, usually all industries, and when they start to get into IT-related technologies, like connecting some systems to internet or using some IT-related technologies, they usually fail into doing that in a secure manner at the beginning. So for 1-2 years, usually a lot of new industrial equipment is being connected to internet or to similar technologies. And after that, they realize that they have to take care of the security also, and they usually do a proper job, or they try at least. But yeah, at the beginning, it's quite common for things like that to happen.
You said you didn't ever use it on real airplanes. So do you think, I know you're talking with the respective air agencies, do you think they could actually test it with real airplanes if they wanted to?
As far as I know, my company is actually trying to coordinate and arrange some kind of work to agreement to work together so we can start testing my research on a more real environment to know exactly if it really applies or not, up to which level, and try to fix all the issues.
I really don't know much about this, but would it be possible, like, you know, there's DDoS attacks and things like that. If you had enough people who had enough access, could you have the same sort of attack where it just confuse the flight systems, as it were, if you had enough people trying to access the flight system, as it were?
Well, to be honest, I never focus on the DDoS attacks. I know that previous research has been done for the last years on ADSB and ACAR security. Maybe for those protocols, a DDoS attack can have more sense. But as I said, I didn't focus on that, so I really don't know if it could be possible.
And the really interesting thing, I guess, from just a general consumer perspective, is that we have, you know, encryption with buying things on Amazon, but this wasn't encrypted, these signals. Why was such a security breach, I guess, left open? Or is it just, like you said, that 1 to 2 year gap where things need to catch up?
I assume you're asking me why those communication channels and protocols are not encrypted?
Yes.
Well, I can just speculate about that because nobody asked me, so I don't really know why, but I guess that cannot be that easy because there are many, many different companies and airlines and ground service providers and a lot of people involved that has to be coordinated in order for some kind of encryption to work. Maybe for economic reasons, maybe because these are really old technologies in some cases, dating from back the 70s, and it's hard to improve them and update them to use encryption. To be honest, I don't know, it's just guessing. You should have to ask another organization, not me.
In the article I read, it said it took you 3 years to do this. Was that just because of assembling all the parts, or was it that difficult to actually do the work and figure out how to access the data?
Well, actually, it was a combination of both. One hand, I spent many years because for many years, it was just a private personal research that I did on my spare time, 1, 2, 3 hours per day and not every day. And on the other hand, I had limited resources and budget, so I most of the time couldn't get straight all the material I would need. Anyway, it's really hard research. It's not easy. It cannot be done in just 1 week or 1 month. It takes time and a lot of study and resources. So don't be afraid. It's not something everybody can do in just 1 week.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
So what has been the response from, like, the airline industry or from, like, the airline authorities to this?
I think the response has been quite good. On one hand, they are trying, as I said, to coordinate with my company in order to arrange some agreement of collaboration. So they are, looks like they are willing to help, to work with us in order to fix the issues and to verify the findings. And on the other hand, they are trying to talk with most of the media in order to fix some misunderstandings, like an airplane can be hijacked with simple Android application, which is, of course, wrong, or many other incorrect statements that some media are just writing down. So I think their response is quite good.
Yeah, the articles I seem to see are focusing on that you can literally hack a plane with a Samsung Galaxy, which is now, we know, completely wrong. So that's good.
Yeah.
And finally, you presented this at the Hack in the Box Security Summit in Amsterdam. What is the Hack in the Box Security Summit? That sounds very exciting.
Hack in the Box, it's a security conference that happens, I think, twice a year. One of them in Kuala Lumpur and another one for the last years in Amsterdam. And it's just a meeting for many security experts from all around the world. Some of them, like me, just go to present their research, and other people just go there to learn about the others' research and to have a good sharing of knowledge and a good time.
What do you want to do further with your research? Do you want to take this this kind of theme and figure out what else you can do, or do you have other interests in security as well?
Well, as I showed during my talk, what I presented on at Hacking the Box was just a small part of my research regarding aviation security. I have done many other things. I'm doing actually some other things, and I have many others in mind. But of course, I'm not just working on aviation security. I have real work also to do that my company gets paid for, which is always good. And I have a personal life I would like to be able to take care of, and you know, it's just something I do, but it's not the focus of my life.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. That was very interesting, and it's always good to know that the media is getting it wrong, and I can feel relatively safe going on an airplane.
You can still feel safe because aviation is really, really safe. And we are working to make it even secure.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your interest.
So, funny story. You know how this whole austerity thing and the cuts and all of George Osborne and his smug face saying it's necessary? Well, it turns out that the justification for all of this could be based upon a broken Excel spreadsheet. The one time you'd want a paperclip to pop up and help you. It looks as though you were about to publish a major paper providing the academic justification for a relentless dogmatic assault on the poor. Are you sure about that? Why didn't that appear? Here's Keir Little to explain a little bit more.
The 24th of February 2010. The Right Honourable George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer, delivered the 2010 May's lecture. In his lecture, he detailed why he believed the economy was in a right old mess, and why the government's current approach, austerity, was the way forward to save Britain and fix the economy. However, recent developments within the field of economics may give Osborne reason for embarrassment, particularly given that within this speech he states that perhaps the most significant contribution to our understanding of the origins of the crisis has been made by Professor Ken Rogoff, former chief economist at the IMF, and his co-author Carmen Reinhart. Now, in 2010, these economists released a paper entitled Growth in a Time of Debt. Their main result is that median growth rates for countries with a public debt over 90% of GDP are roughly 1% lower than otherwise average, mean, growth rates are several percent lower. Countries with debt-to-GDP ratios over 90% have a slightly negative average growth rate, in fact. This has been one of the most cited stats in the public debate during the Great Recession. In Path to Prosperity by Paul Ryan, they stated that this study found conclusive empirical evidence that debt exceeding 90% of the economy has a significant negative effect on economic growth. A Washington Post editorial board took it as an economic consensus view, stating that debt to GDP could keep rising and stick dangerously near the 90% mark that economists regard as a threat to sustainable economic growth. However, a new paper was published this week entitled Does High Public Debt Consistently Stifle Economic Growth? A Critique of Reinhart and Rogoff, in which Thomas Hendon, Michael Ash and Robert Pollan of the University of Massachusetts successfully replicate their results. Well, they attempted to successfully replicate their results, but they failed. And as they failed, they reached out to the authors of the previous study and asked if they were willing to share their data spreadsheet. This allowed the authors to see how Reinhart and Rogoff's data was constructed and how they had come to their conclusion. There were some issues, and three of these stand out. Reinhart and Rogoff used a process of selective exclusion. They used the years 1946 to 2009 as their period, with the main difference among countries being their starting year. In their dataset, there were 110 years of data available for countries that have a debt GDP over 90%, but they've only used 96 of those years, and their paper did not disclose which years they excluded or why they excluded them. The authors of the new study find that they exclude Australia between the years of 1946 and 1950, New Zealand 1946 to 1949, and Canada 1946 to 1950, and this has consequences for their conclusions, as these countries have high debt and solid growth. Canada had a debt to GDP over 90% during this period and 3% growth. New Zealand, over 90%, and again an average growth rate that was at 2.58%. And if you only use last year, as Reinhard Rogoff paper does, it has a growth rate of 7.6%. This is a big difference, especially considering how the countries are weighted. Unconventional weighting is another issue with this study. The country years are divided into debt-to-GDP buckets. Then the average real growth is taken from the country within the buckets. So the growth rate of the 19 years that the UK, for example, is above 90% debt-to-GDP, are averaged into one number. These country numbers are then averaged equally by country to calculate the average real GDP growth weight. Now, you possibly don't want to give equal weighting to years, and perhaps you want to take episodes, but the weighting used in this paper significantly reduces the average. If you weight by the number of years, you find a higher growth rate above 90%. Reinhard Rogoff don't discuss this methodology. They don't give any reason why they're weighting this way or a justification for this method in their paper. But interestingly, doing it this way supports their conclusion. But perhaps the most mind-boggling of all the errors involved in this highly influential paper is the coding error. As Hendon Ashpollen, one of the authors of the new study, puts it, a coding error in the Reinhard Rogoff spreadsheet entirely excludes five countries, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, and Denmark, from the analysis. Reinhard and Rogoff averaged cells in lines 30 to 44 of their Excel spreadsheet, instead of lines 30 to 49. This spreadsheet error alone is responsible for a minus 0.3 percentage point error in their published average real GDP growth in the highest public debt stroke GDP category. Belgium in particular has a 26 years with debt to GDP above 90% with an average growth rate of 2.6%, although this is only counted as one total point due to the weighting above. In light of this error, the blog of the Roosevelt Institute note wryly that if this error turns out to be an actual mistake that Reinhardt and Rogoff made, well, then all we can hope is that future historians note that one of the core empirical points providing the intellectual foundation for the global move to austerity in the early 2010s was based on someone accidentally not updating a row formula in Excel. Let's just repeat that. All we can hope is that future historians note that one of the core empirical points providing the intellectual foundation for the global move to austerity in the early 2010s was based on someone accidentally not updating a row formula in Excel. That is a fairly damning indictment of the methodological rigour and competence of the researchers involved in this paper. Though, of course, it is worth noting that in economics, as with most things, one swallow does not make a summer, and there are other economic cases for austerity. However, this one very popular study that supports the coalition government's cuts to roll back the state and their austerity programme has been found to be seriously flawed, and that is worrying in the extreme. At the least, this is a red face for George Osborne, and at worst, we should perhaps question the economics that is leading us to cut public spending and to roll back the state.
So last Saturday at the QED Skeptics Conference in Manchester, there was a collective gasp in horror as last Saturday's Independent once again put the discredited Andrew Wakefield on the front page, who sadly is continuing to spout nonsense about the MMR vaccine without any actual evidence to back it up. I know, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, at the time when some people are campaigning to get rid of page 3, the Independent go and put a dick on page 1. Yep, it seems like the whole MMR autism thing isn't dead and buried. So to remind us of the facts, here's Tanis Pendergrass with more.
I do a talk about autism and quack therapies, and within that talk I mention vaccinations as a purported cause for autism. Of course, we know that's not the case, and historically, in order to fit my talk into 45 minutes, my slide on the MMR vaccine has been cut. It simply reads, MMR, I'm sick of MMR. I then go into a very short rant about how MMR should not and should never have been part of the dialogue when it comes to talking about the etiology of autism. But I may have to alter my talk, since MMR is, again, a blisteringly hot topic. It's a vaccine intended to prevent measles, mumps and rubella. I could rehash the story of discredited former doctor Andrew Wakefield and his unethical studies on children in order to peddle his own single vaccinations. But if you're unaware of this, then can I recommend Daryl Cunningham's comprehensive comic on the subject, available as a link on the show notes. This will give you the background you need if you don't already know. The media frenzy surrounding his study results has, without a doubt, clearly influenced the conversation around autism and even vaccines in general. Unfortunately, the British propaganda slogan, "Careless talk costs lives," is true in cases where journalists take a story like this and run with it for years and years and years. Even in January this year, we had a story in the Daily Mail with the headline, "American parents awarded $600,000 in compensation after their son developed autism as a result of vaccine." An article by David Gardner, which had an exceedingly misleading headline, given the article itself acknowledges that the decision doesn't apportion blame or lay fault for the child's condition with the actual vaccine. What many parents don't realise is that measles is highly infectious and can lead to blindness and death. Most people, since the measles vaccination was introduced in the UK in 1968, 63 in the US, haven't seen a child really suffer with the illness, as herd immunity quickly strengthened. Whooping cough is another deadly illness, with 5 children dying in 2012. These are children who are too young to be vaccinated, under 13 months old, and they're really suffering from the reduction in herd immunity. Between January and June 2012, there were 2,466 confirmed cases, children who are suffering for no good reason. 15 years since Wakefield's study was first published, we're now seeing the deadly and injurious results. An increase of measles cases can be clearly seen since then. In fact, in Swansea, at the time of writing, Thursday 18th of April, 750 children have been infected. As Sarah Deaton wrote in The Guardian on Monday, April 8th, with measles cases so low, it was easy to forget what the vaccines were protecting us from. The illnesses sound almost picturesque, vintage diseases from the 50s. It was as difficult to imagine as the taste of Spam. But now Wakefield is on the offensive. He claims, originally on ageofautism.com and now republished on Saturday's Independent front page, that the British government is culpable for the measles outbreak, since they have denied parents the single vaccines he was championing. The trouble with single vaccines is that there's little evidence of a benefit for them over the combined. Wakefield claims they're not in use solely because the government is trying to cover up the dangers of the combined vaccine, and this is motivated by money. However, single vaccines involve delaying protection for children, risking missing doses, the trouble of attrition, and injecting them 3 times instead of just once. Adam Finn, quoted in The Independent on Saturday, said, "His proposal for single vaccines came straight out of his head. Single vaccines are used in poorer countries that cannot afford combined. No country in the world has switched from MMR to single vaccines." What's most interesting in this statement for me is that autism is in fact found in every culture and every country in the world, and children are diagnosed with autism whether they've been given a vaccine or not. MMR, as I said, is given at 13 months old, but autism can now be diagnosed as early as 6 months, and most parents notice some kind of developmental delay before their child even reaches 1 year old. In February 2012, the Cochrane Library published a systematic review with vaccines for measles, mumps and rubella in children, and their aim was to assess the effectiveness and adverse effects associated with the MMR vaccine in children up to 15 years of age. They took a massive clump of studies, including 27 cohort studies and 17 case control studies. They concluded that exposure to the MMR vaccine was unlikely to be associated with autism. And then 2 weeks ago, we had the Centre for Disease Control in the US, who released a new study that confirm what we already have enough evidence to assert with really good confidence levels. Those with autism spectrum disorders are no more likely to have had more jabs than the other. Frank Stefano, the lead author, stated his study of 1,000 children simply found no relationship between vaccine antigens and ASD. So why does this continue? Why must children suffer from ignorance? Conspiracy theories are really attractive, unfortunately, and grieving parents who haven't yet come to terms with their child's differences. These are differences they never anticipated. We'll grab onto anything to take away the blame. It is cathartic to suggest an outside agent, such as the government or pharmaceutical companies, are to blame. To put this into real context, these are the same people who told the National Autistic Society in May 2012 that 74% of them who are caring for someone with ASD get no support. Only 28% said they receive good information where to go for support and help. So those who don't get any help and information are often the ones who are sucked into alternative medicines that are often very harmful and very expensive. and you'll end up with an ill, frightened and traumatised child and a much lighter wallet. If you can, tell just one parent about the vaccine scare and the truth behind it. Tell them vaccines are rigorously tested, and if they want to really know about them, they should read a book on the history and development of vaccines and not just do a bit of Googling and call it research. The websites about vaccines seem so plausible and are pseudo-scientific enough to give them a real air of credibility. Unfortunately, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. This has been Denise Pendergrass, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now this week we saw the world grind to a marginally slower pace as around the world, broadly speaking, people probably didn't tune in to watch the funeral of Margaret Thatcher. But you wouldn't know this from the news coverage, or at least that's what Alex Fitch reckons, as he explains in his next report.
So, the events of the last couple of weeks have made a lot of people think, tweet and elucidate about death and funerals. Inevitably, due to the vacuousness of a few celebrities, some people in the public eye have made incredibly inappropriate comments regarding inspirational departed women who made a positive difference to the world through their legacy. I am, of course, in this case, talking about Justin Bieber leaving a comment in the guest book at Anne Frank's house which read, "Truly inspiring to be able to come here. Anne was a great girl. Hopefully she would have been a Belieber." Which is an astonishingly ignorant and self-serving comment, which probably won't make any dent in his sales or numbers of followers, but you never know. In other music-related news, Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead made it to number 2 in the UK music charts last weekend, and number 1 in the download chart. The coverage of this and reportage of Margaret Thatcher's funeral have brought into stark focus debates about censorship and framing of news in the British media. I'll go into more detail about, open inverted commas, the appropriateness of the parties and protests that have been taking place after her death and during her funeral in a minute, but let's look at the purchasing and downloading of the song in question first. Being offensive and being offended are, like many things, in the eye of the beholder. Clearly there are some songs that are offensive to, and let's use the kind of phrase that the tabloid media love, right-minded people. There are several examples that spring to mind, including homophobic hip-hop and dancehall songs by the likes of Beanie Man and Buju Banton, which include hate lyrics, and thankfully some of these performers have been banned from even entering the UK and have their concerts picketed. However, if you look at the list of songs that have been banned by the BBC, for example, over the last few decades, it's an incongruous mix, with various songs by the Beatles, together, such as I Am the Walrus and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and separately, such as John Lennon's Imagine and Wings' Hi Hi Hi, briefly banned due to lyrics that were suggestive of sex, drugs and pacifism. During times of conflict in particular, the net for possible offence caused to listeners of radio is cast even wider. The occasion of the first Gulf War was a particularly busy time for censorship of playlists, with songs that had provocative lyrics and titles, such as The Cure's Killing an Arab, Cher's Bang Bang, My Baby Shot Me Down, and Walk Like an Egyptian by The Bangles, all being pulled. Certainly these range from the ridiculous to the sublime. Cher, who we're happy to report isn't deceased, to any youngsters on Twitter who misunderstood the hashtag Now That Cher's Dead, is among a group of 60s fembots like Lulu, who sang ditties that sounded like ordnance. While The Cure's song, supposedly written with high ideals, after consideration of Albert Camus' The Outsider, was probably lost somewhere in translation on much of the key audience. This is nothing new, with Don't Let's Be Beastly to the Germans by Noel Coward being pulled from the airwaves in the dog days of World War II. But it's the idea of offending and pandering to a key audience that is the main consideration. During a war, radio audiences, both young and old, might read a little too much into suggestive lyrics. But after a death, does everyone have to be sensitive to previously innocuous songs? Refusing to play more than a few seconds of Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead certainly seems like overzealous censorship to me. Neither Tories nor members of the former Prime Minister's circle of friends or family are likely to be listening to the chart show, and the young listeners who are aiming their lols and zongs at Bieber and Cher on Twitter are unlikely to understand the reasons why a song from The Wizard of Oz is currently offensive to some people, unless it's made a cause célèbre by the likes of the Daily Mail or framed as a news report by the BBC themselves. Reporting on the life, death and funeral of Margaret Thatcher since her demise has surely exacerbated any offence that might be felt by Tories on her behalf. If the tabloids didn't try to create more indignant offence at some people rejoicing in her death, then there might be less offended people all round. Certainly the ghoulish fascination of TV reports and newspaper front pages with the likes of Carol Thatcher and George Osborne in tears is more offensive to me in terms of overemphasising and intruding into their grief than people in Yorkshire who have had to live with destroyed communities for a generation raising a cheer as the coffin went past on TV. Personally, to paraphrase Donnie Darko, I think Osborne is the f***ing Antichrist, but to politicise and be amused by his tears at a funeral really is offensive. As the media have painfully pointed out over and over again since Thatcher's death, the majority of people have had a dignified response to her passing, and a small minority who, open inverted commas, don't represent right-minded people, have inappropriately celebrated her passing on. Well, the question is it inappropriate? When anyone dies who has had a powerful effect on you, whether it's a friend or family member or political leader who changed the course of your destiny, there is a period of, if not mourning them, coming to terms with their absence in your life. The classic five stages of grief, according to the Kubler-Ross model, are supposedly denial, anger, depression, bargaining, and acceptance. When people around the UK lost their homes and their livelihoods due to some of Thatcher and her government's policies in the 1980s, they may have gone through these stages in trying to come to terms with what had happened to their lives, but perhaps never had any kind of cathartic resolution by proxy or referred comeuppance regarding Thatcher herself, who for many embodied the misfortunes that were piled upon them. Certainly Maggie was ousted from office by her friends and colleagues, who in turn were replaced by New Labour in more than one way, after another election. But that wouldn't have been punishment enough for her, according to her enemies. Certainly she was humiliated and sidelined in Parliament, but not truly punished. To someone not emotionally invested in her government tenure, it seems harsh to jeer at the funeral procession of an 87-year-old woman who had suffered in her dotage, and to hang effigies of her, let alone, God help us, enjoy the unlikely success of a song from The Wizard of Oz in the charts, almost as old as she was. But for people who did hate her, and with good cause, her death and funeral was a chance for catharsis, for resolution, for some kind of ending to the narrative that had ruined their lives. The tabloids who quickly condemned those who saw pleasure in Thatcher's passing were equally complimentary of people who had suffered in dictatorships around the world, taking the opportunity to celebrate the ousting and demise of various leaders removed from power during the Arab Spring and elsewhere. How sympathetic we were, and how courageous were the people of Egypt, who could burn effigies of Hosni Mubarak and cheer when he suffered a stroke in June 2012, or the people of Libya celebrating the death of Colonel Gaddafi. For people who live in towns around the United Kingdom, who lost jobs, homes, and futures under Thatcher's government, they saw her as much the malevolent dictator as any of the liberated people in the Middle East. We might not understand their point of view without having undergone the same suffering, but surely we can sympathise for their need to have some kind of catharsis or resolution to their perceived subjugation. Certainly no one in the world's media on the earlier occasions commented whether the children, friends and family of the late Colonel Gaddafi might be suffering when they saw people celebrating his torture and murder. As it was in the UK, the parties, the jeering, the carrying of effigies was small scale and mostly done outside of the eyes of Margaret Thatcher's fans and supporters. It's hard to tell how many people did turn up to the funeral to both figuratively and literally turn their back on the cortege. Without being there and travelling the route, one has to rely on the media. The Guardian, for example, gave much coverage to people who did turn up to protest. They also got a reasonably large mention in BBC radio coverage, but a much smaller one on BBC TV. As for people who didn't turn up at all, BBC coverage implied that it was packed throughout the route, and in other locations important to Thatcher supporters, such as her hometown. However, The Guardian showed large stretches of the route bereft of any people at all, with not a single person in front of giant screens showing the funeral in places like Leeds and Edinburgh, with even only a handful at the screening in Grantham. Perhaps The Guardian chose its times well, and took the photos really early, or perhaps not. Perhaps the BBC exaggerated how few the dissenters were, or perhaps not. The truth obviously lies somewhere in between. But over the past 10 days, it's been fairly obvious that a version of history is being written right now, that in generations to come will depict a populist funeral, that especially the majority of Thatcher's political opponents couldn't bring themselves to condemn, even when it cost £10 million during a recession. Overall, the funeral went peacefully. There were no riots. The dissenters, who tore up the streets when protesting at the poll tax a generation ago, stayed at home. And their equivalents today, who are losing their benefits, being made to work when clearly disabled, being made to work for free in Costcutter when overqualified, are perhaps waiting another generation for Osborne and Cameron's funerals to jeer and turn their backs on them. But beyond the battle of the media to variously big up and quieten the presence of Thatcher detractors, beyond the bile spilled at them for daring to have a moment to celebrate the passing of the person who they see as ruining their lives, and beyond the politicisation of every aspect of the past 10 days, since no violence did erupt at the funeral, since no one was really hurt by the protests, and by the brief repopulation of a song sung by Munchkins, surely we can allow everyone to find their own way of coming to terms with Mrs. T's passing, whether it's via reverence or repulsion, just as long as no one, and I mean no one, in the Book of Remembrance at St. Paul's Cathedral, ponders whether she might have been a believer. This has been Alex Fitch, proselytizing for the Pod Delusion.
Now, a recent study has shown that male names are subconsciously given more credibility than female names when printed on scientific papers. And this, as is pretty obvious, is pretty horrifying. But what are the real-world implications of this? This week, Elizabeth Donnelly has been looking at one such case study, or person, as she's known. Here's Elizabeth Donnelly to explain more.
This is Elizabeth Donnelly, sitting at the University College London with Dr. Aisha Raza, who is a neuroscientist here, working on neurodegeneration. She was part of the team that discovered inclusions in Huntington's disease. Last week, Ohio State University issued a press release reporting a study by Sylvia Knobloch-Westwick, which found that male and female communications graduates show significant bias depending on the gender of scientific writers. Students were asked to read abstracts of 150 words and rate their quality. The author names were not prominent, but were on the papers. Overall, participants, of which 70% were female, rated male authors much more highly. Aisha, why is this study important?
The study noted that the gender bias will have important implications over the course of a woman's career in science, especially in grant proposals, promotions, tenure reviews, hiring decisions, and so on. A scholar's sex will be a relevant factor in how he or she is evaluated, as the report stated. All of these small factors will add up over the course of a career and may prevent women from reaching the same career heights as men.
So what's your personal experience in getting work in science academia?
After I graduated, I had worked as a technician in several different labs, generally just to get a taste for which branch of science I was going to go into. And so I continued working for a couple of years trying to find what worked for me. Eventually, I found a lab, a neuroscience lab where I am, and I worked through my PhD as a technician through that, and was able to secure a couple of junior postdoc positions after that. I think it was a lot easier for me because I already had my contacts and my network in place from when I was working in the same environment, and I was able to carry on with my particular research interests as well. A senior postdoc position was a bit harder to come by, but I managed to secure one of those, and it was much harder to do than the junior positions, simply because it meant a raise, it meant that I was responsible for bringing in more grants than I had been before. Those sorts of things became a bit more of an issue.
What are you doing now?
Yeah, I'm working as an honorary research fellow.
And what does that involve?
Basically, I am continuing doing what I was doing, but I don't have any grant funding to do that. I'm still looking for grant money and consolidating my data that I've had with my work and putting out papers and doing a bit of teaching, which is bringing in my bread and butter money. But the teaching is always paid for on an hourly basis rather than sort of as a stipend that most people would get.
So you don't get paid for your prep or your lab work?
No. You're expected to sort of just turn up and do the hours of teaching and are paid accordingly. Additionally, at my place of work, it's turned into a system whereby they pay you by the term and you don't get paid at the end of the week or the end of the month, which makes budgeting a little bit more fiddly.
So what are your prospects?
At the moment, I'm just looking for more funding money and to sort of consolidate what I have in the way of my data and to take my research forward in minimal costs as I can.
I'm surprised because many young people's experience of what it's like to work as a scientific academic will come from programs like the Big Bang Theory, where they obviously have plenty of grant funding work. In fact, I remember reading your article in Fabiana for the Fabian Women's Network, where you talk about the women in the Big Bang Theory. What do you think of these characters, in particular Amy and Bernadette?
I find Amy absolutely fascinating, but I think that's because of being a neuroscientist. I think that her take on primate behaviour is absolutely amazing. Yes, they do seem to be rather well funded, don't they? They don't seem to be worrying over grants or papers quite as much as, well, my personal experience has been not quite as easy, shall we say. That might be something to do with the fact that in the US, funding systems work a bit differently to what we have in the UK.
It does seem they have plenty of money for the harder subjects like physics, but as you say, we don't hear very much about Bernadette and Amy. In fact, Bernadette, who's very, very beautiful and very, very intelligent, seems to have married the least exciting or least alpha male of the characters. And Amy, as a neuroscientist, is almost the butt of the joke that she and Sheldon don't have a fulfilling or sexual relationship. What's your feeling about this?
I think as women in science, we're expected to be non-sexual things that wander around in glasses and white coats. And as you know, sitting here in my lab, that we're anything but. And that's not the case at all. Generally, I think women get quite a bad rap for being nerdy scientists and that we perhaps don't have ways to express our femininity and that we're always sort of in smart suits and white coats. But most of us live in jeans and T-shirts.
So why did you write this article about budding female potential in STEM?
It was basically to highlight the fact that there is a huge lack of understanding about women scientists. Like we've sort of discussed just now, it's not just all about the sexism, it's also how we can improve things for women in science at the moment, because I really think that we're going through something of a bit of a crisis in the UK at least.
So what are you doing about it?
I've set up the Fabian Women's Network Steering Group for Women in STEM, which is a bit of an outreach program asking every woman scientist that I can lay my hands on, basically, about what they feel is required to make the system work better for us. There's the age-old thing of, like, the childcare thing, and then there's always the job share things that people are trying to come up with their ideas of how to make things better for women in science in this country. There's a lot of intelligent women out there who would like more challenging and fulfilling careers, to encourage them to do that. And also we need to give them the choice. There has to be something where they can be actively encouraged into science.
And why do you think that's important for the UK? Because the Fabian Women's Network is a very political organisation.
Yes. Well, in the UK, I think we're really missing a trick, because in the next election, I think there will be more women like myself who will be having expectations of our government to do something for women in science. We do need more funding, essentially. And, yeah, in this time of austerity and economic crisis, I don't think we might have those pots of cash, but there does need to be something to address this problem. As science underpins most advanced manufacturing, so investment in science would be good for the whole of the ailing UK economy.
So basically, putting women into science is great for women, great for science, and great for the UK.
Absolutely. I really think that we really need to work very hard on this and get the results.
Thank you, Dr. Aisha Raza.
Thank you.
If you're a woman working in STEM or studying science and you're interested in the issues raised by Aisha today, go to the Facebook page, Fabian Women's Network Women in STEM Group, where there's a lot more information and you can find out how to get involved. This is Elizabeth Donnelly interviewing Dr. Aisha Raza for The Pod Delusion. So
So way back in December 2011, on the Pod Delusion, we spoke to NASA's Ed Stone about the Voyager probe, because we thought that it had just left the solar system. But since then, there have been a number of other stories at different times, also about Voyager leaving the solar system. So, has it actually left? And where the hell is it? This week, Steve Dobson has been trying to figure it out.
My earliest memories are of watching the splashdown of Apollo 11. I can't distinguish watching the actual moon landing from the reruns that I've watched since then. But I was glued to the box. Of the splashdown itself, I have a clear memory. My mother, kind person that she is, warned me that I might not get to see the splashdown if the spacecraft came down some distance from the rescue ships with their camera crews aboard. Now, 40-plus years later, I've realised two things. One, the calculations made by the scientists and engineers probably foretold the splashdown point with a high degree of accuracy. And two, why was my mother warning me if it was a rerun? She would have seen on the news if the splashdown had been recorded or not. So I grew up, like many, fascinated by the space missions being performed by NASA. But the one that stands out as exceptional, even with today's much improved technology, are the Voyager probes launched in the 1970s. The Voyager story starts in 1961, when Michael Minovich, a 25-year-old graduate student of mathematics working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, that part of NASA that looks after the unmanned missions, was asked to look for future planetary positions with a view to sending out a probe or two. He realised that the alignment of the four gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, would shortly line up such that the single spacecraft could visit all four. So the race was on. Build and launch two spacecrafts by 1977, or miss the opportunity for another 175 years, give or take. The mission was, by any account, incredibly successful. It was Voyager that first sent back the first evidence of volcanic activity on another world, when, in 1979, it flew past Io, a moon of Jupiter. It was Voyager that showed that Saturn had small moonlets that shepherded the rings, and that the rings themselves were far more complex than we had hitherto expected. Uranus was something of a letdown, it has to be said, a bland planet with very little to capture the imagination. But Neptune was a surprise. So far from the Sun that the Sun itself looks little different from any other star in the sky, Neptune turned out to have the fastest wind seen in the solar system, and of course, we also discovered the Great Blue Spot. Over 12 years, there were four flybys, each lasting only a few hours, but from these came some incredible and unexpected science, far too much to cover in this short podcast. Voyager has expanded our knowledge of the outer solar system like nothing before or since. True, Galileo and Cassini have refined that knowledge, but it was Voyager that showed us that it was worth sending out better-equipped spacecrafts. In 1990, Voyager 1 pointed its cameras back along its flight path and took a sequence of images showing the Sun and its family of planets. The most distant pictures ever taken, at a distance of around 3.7 billion miles, the Earth is nothing more than a pale blue dot in just one of those frames. And the Voyager mission isn't over. JPL is still in contact, and Voyager is still sending back new science. Today, both spacecraft's cameras are shut down, but there are still sensors operating that are sending back some useful readings. Readings about the solar wind, about particles in that region of space, and of the Sun's magnetic field. Both crafts are at the edge of the heliosphere, the limit of the Sun's influence. They are not in interstellar space yet, but it could happen at any day now, or at any month, or maybe in a year or two. Nobody knows, because nothing has been this far out from Earth before, and everything Voyager sends back to now causes scientists to rewrite their models. On Tuesday, Dr. Edward Stone, a former director of JPL and a mission scientist on Voyager since 1972, gave a talk on the latest findings from Voyager at the Smithsonian. His lecture was webcast, and it should be available on the Smithsonian's website shortly, if it isn't already. I'll leave a link to it in the show notes. If you're in any way interested in space, it is well worth watching, both for the new science being revealed to us, and for the reminiscence of the main Voyager mission by someone who was there from the get-go. This is Steve Dobson, looking up at the starry, starry sky for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do head over to our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3.5 years worth of archives, as well as loads more on the Pod Delusion extra feed. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into those sorts of things. And do head over to our Facebook page to see all the pictures of us at the QED conference in Manchester with our glistening new award. Also on our website, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really do appreciate all the donations, and they help us keep making this show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Liz Luckendorf, Keir Little, Tannis Pendergrass, Alex Fitch, Elizabeth Donnelly, Steve Dobson, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Now, pay attention, Toads. As you know, Toaday is the day we go over the top and cross the B5055 to get to the breeding ponds.
Yeah, about breeding time.
No need for language like that, Private. Oh, breeding time, I see what you mean.
So, will it be safer than it was when we tried to cross last year, sir?
Our allies in Moniash Village are trying to register the area as a migratory crossing, but until they do, we're on our own. Have you read all the briefing documents? The Art of War?
Read it.
The Highway Code?
Read it.
The Wind in the Willows?
We've seen the speed of those lorries, sir. I think we've all got a little bit of wind in the willows.
Oh, ha-ha, Private. Everyone thinks they're a comedian.
No, sir. We're toads, sir.
Then have some discipline, man. I'm literally hopping mad at the moment. Any more undue levity and you'll be frog-marched to the back. Now, the speed limits on this road are high, so as you can see, this is no game.
Feels like we're all going to be playing squash shortly, Major.
Right, that's it. To the back of the unit. To think you could have been a sergeant if you'd only towed the line.
Sorry, sir.
Now, many people have asked me, why did the chicken cross the road? And I doubt it was in order to have sex in a pond. But cross it did, and we will follow its example. I believe that we can succeed in this tarmac traversing task.
Well, there's frog spawn every minute, sir.
Enough from you. Right, I've done the reconnaissance. Once we're safely across the road, we then need to get to the other side of the pond, which we can do by leaping on a series of turtles' backs and logs, of course, avoiding the crocodiles.
Crocodiles, sir? You haven't just been playing too much of the 80s computer classic Frogger, have you?
Ah. Well, this is embarrassing.